Well, I'm actually going to do a sermon on the topic advertised, so be shocked. But it is, again, another sermon that's filled with intellectual and emotional minefields about humanism, religious humanism, and why those words aren't just complete contradictions, or why we can't just get rid of religion and have humanism, or get rid of humanism and have religion. Can we at all inhabit the same space? And I obviously believe that we can, and I want to talk a little bit today about why I think that's true. First of all, of course, I get trouble from everyone because of the business I'm in, the religion business. Whether it's teaching at a university or here, I'm consumed with issues of religion, and I'm immediately accosted by people who are saying, "How can you be involved with religion? Look at all the evil that has been done in the name of religion, under cover of religion. Look at the terrible things that people do in the name of their particular gods. How they rationalize the destruction, how they use it to motivate the destruction of human beings, of their homes, of their lives, of their groves." You can go back into the Bible and just see hideous, hideous slaughters of human beings done in the name of God and goodness and religion. So it's really a dirty word, and if we got rid of it, everything would be really cool, and we could all go down to the seashore, and it would be great. And then I have people who just look at the history of the world and say, "Well, just a second, we got problems on the other side also." There was a conversation that went on, a debate after Auschwitz, where the question was asked of the religious, "Where was your God then? Why didn't your God save you, so you must throw religion out?" And indeed, there were people, survivors of the Holocaust, of the Shoah, who after that said, "I want nothing more to do with religion. I want nothing more to do with my own religion, with your religion, with religious institutions, because I feel abandoned and betrayed." But there were people on the other side who said, "Well, just a second, where was humanity at Auschwitz? Where was humanity in the Armenian genocide? Where was humanity in all of the various slaughters that have gone on? If God didn't save people in the Shoah or those other extermination events, and if human beings from the highest culture of the West, of Germany, with art, with philosophy, with music, if they couldn't be decent and civilized without God and without humanity, the outlook seems to be just a little bit bleak. Maybe the extremist positions aren't the best place to be. Maybe the common denominator is not so much the philosophy, but the human beings who do these things to each other, gods or no gods." Of course, today we look at the newspapers. I'm sorry. That's really old school. That's this gray beard here. I look at the newspapers, and the rest of you online and on television see that the world is a mess. And again, much of it is being done in the name of religion. And when we look today, whether it's jihads, or whether it's jihads between Sunni and Shia, or if we go back in time to crusades and to inquisitions, we see all of that. But just in this century, we also see the horrors that were done by Stalin and his purges, with tens of millions killed, of Sukarno and his extermination of the communists, of Pol Pot and his extermination of damn near everyone, and of the Nazis and the Holocaust, not done in the name of God, done in the name of paradise, of a greater good, of some philosophy. We human beings can find the reasons and the excuses to get in each other's grills, to find a difference of color, of gender, of sexuality, of preference of a sports team. There have been wars fought over soccer. There have been riots over baseball games. There are hostile environments at a lot of football games. We don't need to blame it on God. We don't need to blame it on anyone else, as Pogo observed. We have seen the enemy, and it's us. So when I'm looking at issues of religion, and I confess to being of a religious persuasion, people are then saying, well, then you must believe in a supreme being. You must believe in a white-bearded dude up in the sky in a toga and a golden throne that sends good weather to the picnic if you ask for it right, that makes famines and floods and droughts and closes the freeways at the most inopportune times, and of course determines sports events. This explains, incidentally, if you have that kind of theology, why the world is such a mess, because God's on ESPN and going back and forth between events, because you always hear the athletes, well, that ball was just guided into my hands by the good Lord. Good Lord made me score that knockout in the first round. That's not my theology. That's not what I mean when I say religious. That's a straw man and a straw God. The great line that I've quoted before from Rabbi Ken of this very building and grounds, who was being accosted during one of our team teaching events by one of us, you will not be identified. Where's Ed sitting? Said, you know, how can you believe in that God? And his answer was, you know, I probably don't believe in the same God you don't believe in. That's a great line, and it is a great truth. That's a straw man up there. When I use theological language, I'm looking for the poetry. I'm looking for the images. I'm looking for the values that we express, that we stammer in trying to understand our connection to the source of life and our connection to values. The religious person will frequently accost the humanist who believes that women and men are the measure of all things, that we create our own values, that we are responsible for them, and that is certainly my position. But the religious will then accost me, see, I get it from both sides, and say, but if there's no God, then anything is permitted. There's no reason not to steal Judy's purse. There's no reason not to download my sermon off the internet. Don't tell them, honey. There's no reason to be good unless there's a daddy in the sky who says, be good or I will burn you in hell for eternity. I don't need a daddy in the sky. I believe that we have instincts for good and evil. I think that we mostly know when we're doing wrong because we turn our backs and hide it. We don't need to have a theological construct to do that. But I don't object to the poetry. I don't object to the language, to the traditions that we have through the Bible and through many of the ways, the holy scriptures of all humanity, that try to give us examples of how people have wrestled with the great questions of life, of death, of community, and of meaning. I seek nourishment, spiritual nourishment, from those words, from those psalms, from those songs, from those traditions. I am a disciple of somebody named Mordecai Kaplan, who Judy has heard of, and his line for humanity was this: the modern person needs to learn how to take religion seriously without taking it literally. How to do what a lot of religions say that you shouldn't do, and that is to see the smorgasbord, to be cafeteria Catholics or Episcopalians or Unitarians, and pick and choose or leave those things that you find to be nourishing and good for you, or leave the things that are bad. And one of the things that we do in the sharing of all of our traditions is that we make that buffet table larger in spiritual food. We make it larger in terms of what it is that we can pick and choose and share. We come together and it's a wonderful opportunity to learn, to share, to find out what nourishes other people and to find out what doesn't. That's one of the great things about coming together in this kind of organization, where we take our world seriously. We take the religious calling of community, because that fundamentally, as you've heard many times, is my understanding of religion. It's not about my belief in the existence or non-existence of a Sky Father. It is about my belief that people can come together in community of caring. Religare is the root word of religion, and it is caring community. Its opposite is negligare, which is the root of neglect. So when I say I'm religious, it isn't about what I believe. It's about what I try to do. It isn't about what I think a Sky Daddy or Mommy wants. It's what we as a community coming together to search for values and to find ways of making those values flesh, turning them into action. When we say service is our prayer, that's what we mean. Take those values and turn them into service, not simply asking for something. There's no better day to talk about the role of religion and religious language than this day and this week as we celebrate the 50th anniversary of Martin Luther King's great I Have a Dream speech. Can you imagine what it would be like if that civil rights movement had been bereft of religious imagery and language? Think about who the leadership was. Ministers, largely black Baptist ministers, in Martin Luther King's case, a black Baptist minister who had gone to an ecumenical seminary where he had gone to school with Catholics, with Jews, with Unitarians, and was influenced by, as you know, Gandhi and Thoreau. His language was biblical. His images were biblical. The leadership of those marches, when you see the films, and I'm sure many of you will this week, you will see priests and ministers and rabbis marching together. When you look at the martyrs of that movement, when you're talking about Goodman and Schwerner and Cheney, different spelling, and the Unitarian minister James Reeb, who was killed in the civil rights movement, you're looking at people who were coming out of a religious tradition of social justice, who were coming out of a milieu of values. Not that they took it literally, that justice will roll down like rivers from Micah, but they took it seriously, and their lives were informed and inspired by the poetry. I have been to the mountaintop and seen the promised land. That's right out of Exodus. You strip the image and the language. You take the beating heart out of what this was really all about. Martin Luther King said and quoted, "This will be the day when all of God's children will be able to sing with new meaning, 'My country, 'tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, of thee I sing. Land where my fathers died, land of the pilgrim's pride, from every mountainside let freedom ring. And if America is to be a great nation, this must be true. So let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring from the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain, Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain, Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill in Mississippi. From every mountainside, let freedom ring. And when this happens, and when we allow freedom to ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed the day when all of God's children, black men and white, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing, in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last, great God Almighty, we are free at last." Strip that for a moment of its history, of its poetry, of its music. Strip "I Have a Dream" to "I Have an Idea." Strip "Let Freedom Ring" to "Jeremy Bentham informs us that it would be better for all of us to work together nicely." To quote the categorical imperative, "Let us all, please, in the name of sweet reason, act as if the maxim of our action would be universalized into a universal principle." I am moved now, people. I want reason. I want logic. I want values that are examined. But damn it, I want poetry. I want music. I want to be able to sing wholeheartedly and not simply have to take the words literally, but to be moved, whether it's from the Kol Nidra on Erev Yom Kippur to Bach's B minor Mass, to the hymns, to the folk songs, to the patriotic songs that we sing. "Confirm thy soul, America, in self-control, thy liberty in law." Words and music, they take the skeleton that we form with reason, they take the structure of our impulses and our commitments, and they give it a beat. They give it a song to sing, a song to share, a joyful noise to bring us together. We sing together not because we have to believe in the words. We sing together for the experience of being joined, of the experience of being able to make music out of dissonance. I'm sitting here or standing here singing a hymn. Helene is trying her best not to hit me, because normally if I sing in public or private, there's an elbow. I'm trying to make it so that Don doesn't hear me, but I can hear him, since he's a professional, well enough that maybe I can match tones with him, but I can't. But we take all of this together and we create harmony. It's an experience. You can explain it scientifically. There's a reasonable explanation why, if you take enough voices, you can build them up together into something musical. If enough people are marching, you can set off a vibration of creation or of destruction. We're responsible for what we do. But I need inspiration. And inspiration and theological images and biblical images and hymns and songs and anthems are not replacements for commitment. When we sing, "God, confirm thy soul with self-control, thy liberty with law," I'm not saying, "Okay, I'm ready to sit back and just have God do it for me." My call, my prayer, is a commitment to my action and my active efforts. So yes, I am a humanist, and I am responsible for my religion, and I am religious. I want to be gathered together with fellow seekers and searchers and sinners and singers to make a difference in empowering each other to make a good difference in this world we share.